you have to really understand the value proposition, that it's going to be so worth it on the other end. You know, that what you go through on this front end of working through it is going to pale by comparison to what you're going to get.
Hello, and welcome to the Mindset and Self-Mastery Show. I'm your host, Nick McGowan, and today on the show, I have Gigi Denard. How are you doing today?
I'm doing great, Nick. Really glad to be here.
I'm excited you're here. I think we're going to have a great conversation. And there's some stuff that we're going to be able to touch on that was interesting as you and I were talking before we hit record about what some sort of taboo topics can be at times. Like people shy away from politics. They shy away from religion. I often think there's something to that. Like there's some trauma behind it or some aversion to it or what have you. And I'm excited for us to be able to talk through at least the religious and spiritual side of that, because I do think that there's a lot to that, that we all have kind of come through or gone through or have some issues. But I'm going to take a little bit of a step back here. The platform is yours at the moment. Why don't you tell us, what do you do for a living? And what's one thing that most people don't know about you that's maybe a little odd or bizarre?
Okay, so my name is Gigi Michelle Denard, and I am an author and a speaker, and I also do commercial loan consulting in a different kind of vein. Sure. And one thing that people don't know about me that's probably a little odd is that I happily took 7 years of Latin from fourth grade through 11th grade. Yeah.
I don't know whether I'm more impressed you did it for 7 years or they started you at fourth grade with it.
Yeah. Yeah, the schooling was definitely a little different as I've met other people and talked to them and found out what we did in third and fourth grade. I realized that, a lot of people really didn't do that. You know, when you're there, you don't know, right? Like that's not normal. but yeah, started at French in third grade and added Latin in fourth grade. And
so what sort of fancy school did you go to?
it was actually a public school in Palm Beach.
Okay, cool.
But they did have a program, a gifted program that they were starting. So they started out with a small group of us, like six, as a pilot program, so to speak. And then they continued. So
that's pretty cool. So have you actually used Latin in life since then?
Actually, it comes in really handy. Cool. As a reader. And linguist in general. I've studied a lot of languages.
Okay.
And, you know, when I was even in college, a lot of times people would comment about my vocabulary. Mm. I went to law school, and a lot of times people would assume that it was because I went to law school that I had the vocabulary that it is. Says, no, it actually comes from my language study. So when you've studied Latin, Greek, French early on, you can reconstruct a lot of stuff. And so vocabulary came easily and it was easy to sort of build on it because of that. So in that context, yes.
Well, that's an interesting way to look at it. It's interesting. I find myself still at times like phonetically sounding out a word. Even if I know what the word is, it's just like, it just happens at times. It's like a recall back to being a little kid. And there, and it's like, oh yeah, I remember like, this is how this works. This is why this is. Exhibitor comes to mind, like exhibitor.
Right.
And I'll still read it like that. I don't say it out loud, but people are like, it's exhibitor. Like,
right.
It's basically like, kind of a zillion there. But that is really interesting how when people know different languages or can speak some different languages, even if it's like pieces of them, you can start to see similarities within it. I've had conversations with people that have come to the US from a different country where they were really, really young and they learned the language as they grew up and it was normal for them. Others that got here in their late teens, their 30s, and it's like they had years and years of just a previous language and then having to learn this language. Like I often think of the word there. There are several versions of there. To somebody in another country that comes over here, it's like, just give me the damn word. Like it should just be the one thing. So it's interesting that you've actually used that still and you're able to do that a little differently. But I think the thing that really stood out to me is you told me or told us that you went to law school, you do commercial loans, and then you have the rest of your business. So how do these all mix together to become you?
Well, now that's a very interesting story because for a long time, that was actually very frustrating and confusing for me. I happen to have been given a series of gifts, have a lot of interests, and felt like I know that there's a connection in here somewhere, but it took years, like years, for me to figure out like that there really is a thread. And so the thread is built all around the name of my business, which is Well-Fed Resources. It's really all about wellness. Every aspect of everything that I do is about wellness. And the financial piece is about financial wellness, but particularly for businesses, right? So I deal with wellness in spirit and soul through the Hunger for Wholeness, through the devotional that I've created, other types of kingdom living type services, workshops kind of things. And then I do other types of wellness in the work arena around business culture. I've published books in about service culture and leadership culture, but it's about the health and wellness of organizations in that respect. So that's the thread. And so once I understood that, okay, so really what I'm looking at is 360 degree wellness. I'm also a chef interested in nutrition and stuff like that. So it's all pointing back into this wellness place.
I love that you brought up the struggle to separate this a little bit. Wellness, to the people that listen to this show, they understand what wellness is and what it can look like and how it's not just a buzzword. But there are people that will use things, like even mindset. I've actually had to have an episode that's like, it's not all about mindsetting your way through things. It's a part of what you do. It's like a flavor to it in a sense. Wellness being a piece, maybe a major piece, and it's easy to put things in that categorical box and say it's wellness. Biggest thing that I looked at is really your struggle to get to that point, because that's one of the big things that we really like to be able to work through and talk about on this show. It's all about purpose. And sometimes it's so fucking difficult to figure out and find out how to do your purpose, what your purpose is, and then what life looks like from that point. So I want to talk a bit about that struggle of trying to figure out where your thread is and sometimes having to unravel things to go, well, my purpose is actually this. I've been going the wrong direction, or I've been slightly off, and being able to actually push yourself together with that, yourself where you're at and your current purpose.
Well, I think the whole purpose piece is critical. And I think it's in finding the core of the purpose that helped me find the thread. And I've certainly had to cut away some things. So now that I have the clarity, it's much easier to see I get invited to participate in this juncture over here, and yet that doesn't really align with my purpose and thread. So I'm not going to devote any time to that. As wonderful an idea as that might be, it doesn't fit, and we got limited time and space. So I've become a lot more vigilant about protecting the purpose for which I feel I am on this planet. And so this whole, and this, you know, ties into, this ties a whole lot of things that you mentioned earlier. I believe that a big piece of my purpose is around healing these, helping people heal in this space of trauma from father wounds, right? But I also believe that a big part of the solution is in learning God's Father heart toward us. I think that that's a big piece of the wholeness. So there's a whole lot of space between trauma and wholeness.
Oh, yeah.
And what I do that I think I do most effectively is help people jumpstart the process. Half of the battle is getting on the road. Getting in the journey, deciding that this is important enough for you to invest some time and perhaps some pain and perhaps some money and whatever in order to really be the best you can be. I mean, I know that sounds really corny, but as I was rebranding my website last year and working with a business coach, you know, when it all boiled down to it, my real passion is to help people reach their full potential. And you can't do that when you've got baggage that's keeping you in bondage. You can't release the full authentic you when you're carrying around this kind of baggage. And so my goal is to help you unhitch this and jumpstart this journey so that you can reach wholeness, so that you can fulfill your potential and you can fulfill your purpose.
Ton of layers to it. Do you find that you work a lot with entrepreneurs, or is it typically just kind of employees?
Not necessarily. I would say that the categories aren't necessarily as much divided by the type of work they do. In this space, I do everything from people, you know, who've been assigned by a court to Job Corps to CEOs, you know, so it's not so much around the workspace, but it's an epidemic, you know, really the rate of fatherlessness or trauma in the home caused by fathers or the absence of fathers is just immense. Mm. So you don't really have to look far to find people who've been affected.
I think you can look at a person, just anybody.
Exactly. Pretty much anybody, yeah. Most people, right? But I think what's my goal is to help people get in touch with the fact that you have issues. Because a lot of times people don't really want to deal with it. Yeah. It's painful, right? There are painful memories associated with this. I would just assume, just like, I'm not talking to him, I'm not thinking about him, I'm going to go live my life, except that you don't really.
Yeah.
You don't really. You're carrying around all this anger, resentment, unforgiveness, yada, yada, which is really jacking you up and not them. And so it's not just a physical separation. This is where this whole mindset mastery, I think, fits very well with what I do. Because you have to be in a frame of mind to understand that you need healing and you need wholeness in order to really be fulfilling what you want to do.
Yeah. I think there are two camps in the sense that we can look at, and this is general in a way, but the people that aren't there yet, they're still mm-hmm. bitching, complaining, but they're not ready to actually do the work and they're mm-hmm. not ready to heal. Then the others that mm-hmm. are like, I'm here, I'm ready. I'm doing the mm-hmm. work, or I'm about to do the work. So I'd like mm-hmm. to talk more about that, because
yes,
that's a whole different story with the people that aren't right. there. Like they're,
yeah,
they need to get there, but they have a lot of they stuff to be there. Able to work to get there. Right. And for the most part, the people who listen to this show are the people that are like, I'm here, I'm doing the work. Mm-hmm. And for the mm-hmm. most part, I think the core of the people that listen to this show are the ones that are like, I'm doing the work, but I'm still mm-hmm. not fully healed, or I'm still working through these things. I found mm-hmm. even with my own journey, and I laugh about this with clients, my coach, mm-hmm. And sometimes people on the podcast, like the more self-aware you are, the more self-aware you are. Right. And the more you're like, yeah. Oh, I see it. Fuck, I see it. And now yeah. I can't get yeah. away from it. And it's like, you right. have to do the work. And in some ways, we're sadists with this, because we like, we're like, just let me sit in the deep end. Go yeah. through it. But being able to understand that we all have childhood trauma. Mm-hmm. I think it's not just fathers, it's mothers, but I'm
it's
really
not just fathers, sure.
But I love that you pointed out, like, there's still a father issue there. Like I think of,
yes.
from my perspective, my mom had me when she was 22, she was a baby. Mm-hmm. I'm almost 40 and I couldn't imagine having a kid that's would be almost 20 at this point. That'd be ludicrous. Mm-hmm. let alone any children. Like that's a whole different story. But she was vastly different than my dad, but they were both basically mm-hmm. kids and they were never together. And there mm-hmm. were problems that I've had with my mom because I didn't have the dad there. And there mm-hmm. are problems that I've had with my dad because mm-hmm. my mom wasn't around, or mm-hmm. just their back and forth. And it's interesting that sure. all of this is tied together. Even if we go, well, it's specifically this, it's like, it's not. So talk to us a bit about your journey, because I think that's
okay.
Like there are nuggets of wisdom that come from that, but you've been able to put that together and go, oh, I can help other people with this. So what did that look like for you to discover that?
Okay. So it began with the fact that I did not meet my father until I was 17. So there was no nothing, no contact, no nothing, no, I didn't know where he lived in the world. You know, I didn't know anything. I knew that my mother had commanded that. So unlike most stories that I hear where a dad has walked out, in this case, my mom left my dad. My mom left my dad first time when she was 6 months pregnant. Fun fact, I'm a honeymoon baby. So, so my mother was 6 months pregnant and walked out on my dad. When I was 6 months old, I found out after meeting my dad came to rescue his family, in Florida. They had been in New Jersey or Delaware somewhere, and, they got back together briefly and she left him again. And it was with the instruction that he was not to have any contact with me. So I had nothing, no connection. And, let's see, how did that begin to spin? Well, the first thing that happened was, you know, kids ask questions, right? My mother never said anything negative about my dad, like at all. It was just kind of like a non-conversation for the most part. Every once in a while, I would do something really random and it would be like him. So it would remind her of him and she would just look and stare like, wow, that's really crazy. You do that just like your dad, you know, that kind of thing. But it was quite a big mystery kind of hole. I mean, I knew he was a minister, but I didn't really know much else. And I was 10, I think, 10 or 11. And I, you know, my mom probably was just having a bad day, but, you know, kids misinterpret stuff all the time. So I asked a question about my father. She yelled at me. And I read that as, okay, this is not an okay topic. So I stopped asking. Just no more questions. But I used to think about my dad all the time and wonder. So when I was 14, okay, so another strange fact, my family's a little interesting in the vine that we're in. So my mother's sister was married to my father's first cousin. In fact, they married first. That's how my mom met my dad. She accompanied her sister to a funeral group, you know, so that's where they met. So I'm at my aunt's house just hanging out. Her son and I are a year and a half apart, and we were really close. And she and I are talking, and out of the blue, I mean, just random, I say, you know, I always wanted a brother named Ricky and a brother named Mickey. Crazy kid stuff, right? Except my aunt's face, I mean, she just looked like she'd seen a ghost. And I was like, that was weird, you know. And then she says, well, you do have a brother named Ricky and you have a sister named Mickey. And that kind of freaked us both out. So I was like, what the heck? Where did that come from? So she also made another decision that day that despite everybody knew that my mom didn't want me to have any contact with that side of the family. But she made a unilateral decision to introduce me to my dad's dad by phone because it was also my cousin's grandfather. So she called him and we started having these clandestine calls. So from 14 to 17, I kept having these calls. Whenever I would visit her, we would call Daddy Ed, my grandfather, right? So finally, I was a senior in high school, and I just decided one day, what the heck, might as well ask her, what's the worst that she can say, you know? but I very quickly said, do you care, you know, is it okay if I invite my father to my high school graduation? To which she said, I don't care if you can find him. So I had a plan. The plan was, I'm going to send my invitation to my father, to his father, and have him forward it. What I did not know, somehow had not come up in any of those conversations with my grandfather, is that he and my dad were not talking. But he forwarded it anyway. So it wasn't until the night before graduation that my father actually received it. He had actually just left an hour from where we lived. He was speaking in Miami. We were living in Fort Lauderdale. He didn't know we were living in Fort Lauderdale. Of course, I didn't know he was speaking in Miami. He got back from Miami and found the invitation for my graduation, which was the next day. So that wasn't working. But he did come 2 months later in July, and I met my dad for the first time. So I would say that the whole journey began there. And one of the things that we discovered very early on was that I wrote just like my dad. Like, he showed me some stuff he wrote. I was like, oh my God, I could have written this. And so for me, there had been a lot of struggle. You're absolutely right. It's not just about the father. So there was a whole lot of trauma already in my life. I looked like my mother, but was nothing like my mother. So that was very confusing because I didn't have the father there to compare. And I just felt like, I don't belong here. Like, what the heck? So I actually made up a story in my mind of how this must have worked. So my mom's youngest sister and I were very close. We also looked a lot alike. Not as much as, you know, my mom, but we looked a lot alike. So my theory was she got pregnant out of wedlock. And since my mom was getting married, they decided to give me the baby to the married couple. Kids think up crazy stuff when they don't know the answer, right?
Trying to find a reason, yeah.
Trying to find a reason, because I think inherently kids look to see themselves in their parents. You know, some kind of rational relationship. And unfortunately, the fact that I looked just like her just wasn't enough. We were so different otherwise that it just felt, I felt like an alien in the house. So there was a lot of trauma around that. The other thing is that I discovered after I met my parents that my father was actually kind of more the nurturer. So I grew up with a very authoritarian mother who probably had some narcissistic tendencies, and no dad. So I meet my dad and it's like, oh my goodness, so much about myself is explained. Like in the first night we meet and start talking, it's just like, oh my God, I'm like that. Oh, I like that kind of stuff. Oh, you know, just all that kind of stuff. And even the first night we met, my mom, I was very nervous about how she would treat him, but that actually turned out really well. And she was very cool. I was nervous all through dinner, but you know, the shoe didn't drop. And about 11 o'clock, she says, okay, I'm going to leave you two to it. And he and I stayed up and played chess till 4 o'clock in the morning.
That's cool.
Yeah. But we started writing our story. So that's how I kind of landed in this path. We decided to write our story, but really initially, I think it was more for our own healing. Mm-hmm. You know, he had healing too from the trauma of not having been with me, right? And so we decided to kind of write our own stories that we were going to then merge together as one, because it would flow because we wrote so much alike. And I don't remember how it came up, but I had a roommate at the time who was teaching an English class at Berkeley, UC Berkeley. And she asked me if I would read it to her class. I said, sure, you know. And then I'm in this room with like all these 20-year-olds crying in the room. I'm like, whoa, okay. Perhaps this is more widespread an issue than I had realized, right? Yeah. And then I met a woman. During that point, I was in another piece of life and was a general manager at Denny's. And I ended up meeting a lady who was in prison ministry. We just kind of started talking, told her that, hey, my dad was in prison ministry. In fact, he came to faith in prison, you know, and told her about the story we were writing together. I shared it with her and she was like, ooh, 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 can I take this and share this in my prison? I said, sure.
Yeah.
If there were ever a population that probably needs it. Yeah, absolutely. So that's kind of how it began. And then I'd say a few years in, we had just, you know, written the story. I came back to DC to visit one of my professors from undergrad. I went to Howard undergrad, was a journalism major. Went back to visit one of my professors that I'd been close to. He'd been kind of like a surrogate father to me. It was really his idea. He read it and he said, wow, this is really great. He goes, if you added like, you know, five or six different people's stories to this, this could really be a powerful book. Hmm. And I was kind of like, huh, okay. 10 years later, that book came to fruition. Up until that time, I still didn't get it yet. I didn't know the purpose underneath that was lying underneath all of this, right? So I write the book. And then a number of just, I would call miraculous, cool things happened, even in the production of that, that really pushed me out on the path.
Nice.
And one was ending up getting the endorsement of Dr. Ken Canfield, who is the founder of the National Center for Fathering. So without knowing me at all, without having any connections to him, I hunted him down, found him. He told me his objections, then asked me to read two other, asked if he could read the two last chapters of the book, and then said, and you'll have an endorsement by the end of the week. So that, I was like, whoa. Okay, so now I'm beginning to feel like there's something to this, right?
Yeah.
Because this is kind of crazy, right? So that summer, he and I kept in touch. The book came out in April. In around July, he called me or wrote to me and said, there's this conference that we're starting around fatherlessness in Portland. I've already told the pastor who's organizing it, you need to be on that program. Hmm. So I was like, okay. It was beginning to feel very big and like kind of outside of like me, like what in the world is going on here? And so the pastor called, who also I could hear it in his voice, like, who are you and why? Because all the other people speaking there were well known in this space, right? And so here am I, the newbie, you know. And later when Dr. Canfield told me what he told the guy, I was kind of blown away, because he told the guy that there was a new voice in the movement, in the fatherless movement, and you really need her there. And I'm thinking like, wow, okay, I didn't know I had a voice. I didn't know I was in the movement. You know, I didn't know any of that. Mm-hmm. Funny how somebody else saw that first, you know, kind of thing. And so I went. It was the inaugural conference. There was packed out, and it was like 400 people in there. And bringing in chairs, you know, and I was the first speaker to open the conference. And it was pretty, at first, pretty intimidating. You know, they had given me 45 minutes. I was thinking, how on earth can I talk about this for 45 minutes? That just felt like so long. You know, I was an orator in high school. I do 10 minute talks. You know what I'm saying? So, you know, 45 minutes felt like an eternity. Yeah, right. Except for the fact that they literally had to like pull me off the stage at 75 minutes. And I could feel the impact in the audience. You know, it was really heavy, intense. We ended up praying over people for a long time after that. And the main complaint, it was, you know, 98% women. The main complaint was that it wasn't long enough. Hmm. Because it, you know, people now opened up, and I felt badly because I felt like, oh my God, I didn't really take them anywhere yet, you know, in this. And my book sold out, and I never got a chance to sign any because I was supposed to get to the lobby to sign, and I never got to the lobby because people just thronged me inside. But have you ever seen that movie, Chariots of Fire?
No.
No. So there, it's about this runner, and it's a true story about this guy who ran, and there's this line in it where he says, when I run, I feel the pleasure of God. And that had always been kind of like a weird kind of statement to me. I was familiar with it, but it was like, what in the world does that mean? Mm-hmm. You know? And I felt it. I felt it for the first time doing this that time. It was like, you were born to do this right here. Right here, this is what you were born to do. And I knew that I knew that I knew that I knew, right? So 4 years later, I was brought back to do that again. But by that point, I'd also developed a workshop because I wanted to be able to do more than just open you up. Yeah. I wanted to be able to help you find a strategy for like getting to the other side. And so that's what I did. So I've created a workshop. It's a jump start. You know, it's not the whole deal because healing is a process. Mm-hmm. It's not an event, right? But it's a jump start to help locate you, help locate your dad in this, you know, scenario, help you deal with unforgiveness and anger and resentment and all of that kind of stuff, deal with those emotions, explain for the fact that while you feel them, they are all decisions and you can make a decision even though your feelings aren't there yet. And that's what we're going to do today. And then I round it out with, then you have to receive, something to fill that emptiness. And so I talk about receiving God's love and a new identity. You have to change the way you see yourself. Yeah. You are not that person anymore. And you have intrinsic value regardless of what happened to you or with you, you know, and so kind of do that whole piece around identity.
A lot of layers to it, whole lot of layers. Yeah. And I'm glad that you even pointed out that it's not an event. It's a whole process. Like I joke with people at times, like the more you process, the more you have to process.
Yeah.
The more that you do processing, the more you understand. It's almost like learning. Like the amount of times people said, like, the more I learn, the more I understand I'm an idiot. I don't know anything. Things start to open up for you. One of the cool things that you had said early on was about the thread and figuring out what that thread was. Mm-hmm. And I think something for the audience to specifically take away, one of the biggest threads just by listening to the story is that you kept going. Like that can be the common thread that will show until the actual thread shows up. And that's stupidly simple, but sometimes we need to hear that to know just keep moving. Just keep working through these things. If you feel like you've done enough processing, if you feel like you've done enough of it, keep going. There's still more to go through and more.
There's still more.
But finding that contentment, I think, is a that too. That's beautiful that you were able to have that relationship with your dad. Sucks that it took it as long as it did. But it took
right.
There's no should.
Exactly.
It's just what you had done with it from that point.
Right. And I feel that there's a redeemed part of that, you know, where it's like for me, and I think probably one of the next books I'm going to write is about pain, purpose in the pain.
Yeah.
And that if you can identify redemptive purpose in the pain, it makes it a lot easier to deal with.
Big time.
You know, so a lot of times I feel like, well, if I needed to go through what I went through in order to help other people go through what they're going through, then that was worth it.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Makes me sad for the people that are coaches because they didn't know what to do in 2020. They didn't know what to do when they didn't have a job anymore and they became a coach.
Right.
But it makes me really excited for the people that did that and went, I got some shit I got to work on. And then it led them to that thread of this is what my purpose is. And I think there's a lot to that. What a beautiful thing to be able to have that relationship that you have with your father. And for us all to be able to understand that it's not just if you didn't have a dad or if you did have a dad, but I think you can also translate that into other things. It's not just about the father. It's the other ways. And even looking at the relationship with the creator and how that ties in. There's a lot of layers to this and we could probably spend a lot of time going through a lot of those layers, but I know that's part of what you do as well. So what's that one piece of advice you'd give to somebody that's on their path towards self-mastery?
I think it's that you really do have to be willing to embrace the pain of going back through, you know, the review part. I think that's why a lot of people avoid it. And I also think you have to really understand the value proposition that it's going to be so worth it on the other end. You know, that what you go through on this front end of working through it is going to pale by comparison to what you're going to get. You know, and it's hard for us to imagine because most of us are not walking around whole. So we don't really know what that freedom feels like. You know, but when you get there, oh my goodness, it is so different. And even layers of freedom, like you said, they're layers. But even getting through a couple of layers, you start to taste that like, oh, wow, I don't do that anymore. I don't have to react to people like this anymore. I don't need this kind of thing from these people anymore. You know, it's huge.
Yeah. That was why I asked earlier about, do you work more with entrepreneurs or employees? Because I think we as entrepreneurs have these situations that happen almost every hour with different things where you have to put fires out or you have to think about this or you have to manage that. Or And yeah, employees need to do that as well. But it's, it's, we're constantly screwing around with these things and trying different things and working on it. And we should be able to look at ourselves that way. But it can be really difficult to do that when you're in the middle of it. And there, there are people that maybe listen to this that are in the middle of it right now that are like, screw both of you, because you don't know what I'm going through. Right. I know that it's going to be brighter on the other side, but screw off or whatever. And it's like, we get it. We've gone through that. Yeah. There are still dark moments no matter what, but it's, it's that consistent movement and that thread. The thing that has come back to me a few times is that thread being like a rope that you can kind of keep pulling yourself along and being on that thread. There's a lot of great stuff that's in here, and I really appreciate you being on the show today.
Thank you so much, Nick. This is great.
Hey, where can people find you, and where can they connect with you?
So the best place to reach out to me is on my website, which is www.wellfedresources.com. And if you go to the healing tab, you'll find all the resources there. You can sign up for the workshop. You can order books. I also have a 12-week companion diary for people who take the workshop. So you can, I can help you sort of virtually continue working on the work.
Awesome. And thank you so much again for being on the show. It was a pleasure to have you.
Thank you, Nick. It was great.